Hello, I'm Hugo Disler from Farming Secrets. We are doing the talk, the walk, in relation to the last DVD and the DVD beforehand, which covered, the last DVD covered mainly composting, and the previous one covered the general introduction to biodynamics. So this particular talk is going to cover both, and we're very, very lucky to have two experts on the line, and which is Hamish Mackay. Hello, Hamish.
Hello, Hugo, and everyone.
And we,
John.
And we have got John Priestley online too. Hello, John.
Hello, Hugo. How are you? And everyone
very
else.
Well. Well. Look, we are going to get going pretty well straight away. Hamish, did you manage to get those questions from George White?
The ones that just came now?
Yeah, I suppose you best how we best treat those. They are to do... They're covering material we covered last time in relation to the various ashes, the liquid you make to make compost, to make a weed product.
Right, okay.
Anyway, I'll bring that in at a bit later stage. At this stage, we will open the line and we'll allow people to... to start asking questions.
Yep.
Now, I think at this stage, to get going, you press star 7 and start talking. So, Stuart, are you in a position to say something or ask a question?
Okay, can...
Yes, keep get going.
Okay, I've watched the DVDs a couple of weeks ago, and it's just a couple of questions. I'll explain myself a bit about my background. I live in Sydney, but I have a property a couple of hours out of Sydney and not intending to move there for the next couple of years. So I'm interested in doing improving the soil prior to me actually moving to my property. So I've got a bit of a head start, if that makes sense.
Good.
And
are you 2 hours north, west, or south?
West of Sydney, out near Bathurst.
Right, okay, yep.
All right.
So probably the first, if I recall some information in the DVDs, I think, Hamish, you said probably soil activator is the first thing to, the first preparation to use prior to 500. Is that correct?
The biodynamic soil activator has the 500 in it.
Okay.
Also, manure concentrate, which has all the compost preparations. It also has horn clay and some silica in it. So that's got. I'm trying to simplify it into getting everything to one product to get started with. Yeah.
Yep. No, that makes sense. That's good. That's that answers a number of my questions there. I'm not in a position to. I only have a couple of hundred acres. I'm currently in a position to mix enough of the product in bulk to spray out on the out onto my property. But I had a thought, and this might be totally wrong, but I can make up some worm compost tea. And I was wondering if I did that, let's say a 1,000-litre batch, if then I added a couple of small amounts of the mixed activator to that, was able to spray that out. Would that be counterproductive, or would that be a small step in moving forward?
No, really good. Adding worm juice to the preparations or vice versa is excellent, yeah? So, yeah. Yes, so you can do that for sure.
Okay, so what I was going to do is have, like, you know, 500 or 1,000 litres of worm compost tea made up, and then add a couple of the 30-litre or 30-gallon solutions that, you know, takes an hour to mix up, if I recall, and add a couple of those and then spray it out straight away as a combination.
Look, the more of it you can stir, the better. In other words, mix it and stir what you're going to put out. That would be preferable, yeah?
Okay. Okay. My next question, if I'm not hogging the airwaves.
Yep, perfect.
is the process that I use to spray out my worm compost tea is via a fire pump, so to speak. Is that suitable to spray the
Richard Bunn does in West Australia, he just uses his fire nozzle strapped onto the back of his ute, and he just has it aiming out one side in a way that gives a good curtain of drops falling onto the ground. Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
So you just set the nozzle at whatever setting will give you the best curtain.
He also uses the fire pump to mix the preparations over the flow form.
Oh yeah, yep. I understand that. I have another question, not necessarily related to that, but in relation to peppering. I'm still not 100% have understood the peppering, but what I'm interested in doing, I have a serrated tussock problem on the property in certain areas, not across the whole thing. And I was interested, I've sprayed with chemicals before. It does kill the actual tussock, but it doesn't prevent the seeds germinating and coming up. So I'm looking for something that, okay, if it takes a couple of years to sort out, but I was interested in explaining the peppering process to me again in relation to something like serrated tussock.
Do you want to do the serrated tussock, John? Because the grazing part, I think, is part of it too.
Yeah, it is part of it, but serrated tussock is there with a job to do in as much as it's trying to get humus back into the soil. And
yes.
With the BD preparations, all of the root growth, instead of just remaining like cardboard does in dead soil, it becomes humus, and you will find that is why serrated tussock is there. Is to replenish the organic matter in the soil.
Okay.
And like we've had, I've got pictures of serrated tussock with roots up to 14 feet long that were, you know, washed out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the, you know, why it is there is to build the organic matter up in the soil.
Right.
And those patches where it is worst, probably as well, yeah, you can collect some of it, roots and all, and when it's got seed and flower on it,
mm-hmm.
and burn it on new moon and mix
full
it
moon.
With your...
Full moon?
Burn it on full moon.
Full moon, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't matter when you collect it and let it dry, as long as you burn it on full moon, and then you can mix it with your preparations. When you put your worm juice and your soil activator out, you can add some of that ash to it, and you will find that it will certainly depress the spreading of it, but the main thing is you've got to get that organic matter in the soil built up to make the serrated tussock redundant.
Okay, so... So it's not an insurmountable task to basically eradicate the serrated tussock over a period of time after the soil is in a better condition.
It just will become redundant. It's there to do a job, and its job is to build up the organic matter in the soil.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And once you've got the bacteria there, to convert all of the organic matter into humus, that's when the serrated tussock will become redundant, and it will just, you know, over 2 or 3 years, you'll find that it will not come back at all. Where with poison, all you're doing is killing the symptom that you've ran out of organic matter in the soil.
Yep,
so
absolutely.
It will continue to come back.
Yeah. John, you spoke of a guy who fattened some cattle on serrated tussock by using molasses.
Yeah, attracted the cattle to graze it off by spraying it with molasses, 1 in 20. And the cattle, like he did a strip every day, and they were mature cattle, full-mouth bullocks, and they absolutely gnawed the serrated tussock down. It's high in cellulose, but it runs short in protein, and when you add the protein via molasses, it becomes attractive to the cattle, and they really flog it down, and I believe probably sheep would react the same way. I don't know because I've not seen it happen. But once you get sunlight onto the ground under those tussocks, you will find that all the sort of seeds, you know, there'll be legumes and native grass seeds that will germinate once the sun hits the soil, or you can actually go across and spread some more just on the surface, just broadcast some more ryegrass. One that's working out well is, lamb's quarter. What do we call that, Hamish? The one that Martin's using.
When we think about it, we can come back on that one.
But anyway, just diversity is the thing. And but getting sunlight into the ground is a tremendous setback for the serrated tussock.
Mm-hmm.
And by making it attractive as feed, the cattle will do that for you.
See, why I think the cattle is really important, because the peppering weakens the any future germination. It's not a knockdown. It won't kill what's there. And I having watched my brother working with weeds in the Braidwood district, the best way is to graze them. You know, you can spend heaps on poisons, but the biodynamic preparations make just about all plants more palatable. And then the molasses on top, and especially if you can graze it, prior to it going to seed, you can actually turn it into meat and sell it rather than having to just more and more poison. And the peppering helps two things. As John said, you let the light in, you get germination, and the biodynamics will help that. And the peppering will weaken the germination of any seeds into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's great. That's great information, though, and it sounds like something
Do you know? Do you know the bridle track at Bathurst?
Yes, I do a little bit. Yep.
Okay. Look for a guy called Harry Whalen out there. He's there's a bit of a group out there that you can connect with. I'll dig up his phone number while we're talking.
Okay, that'll be fantastic.
Yeah, Harry Whalen. There's quite an active group out there.
Okay, it's good to make contact with those people, because then I can read all sorts of things, but at the end of the day, someone demonstrating something or showing me something is makes life easier as far as learning goes for me anyway.
Okay, absolutely. Got a pencil? You got a pencil?
I have.
It's 6337.
6337, yes.
1185.
1185. Okay, and it's Harry Whalen.
Whalen.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. Tell him Hamish sent you and John.
I certainly will.
Yeah, I was there a couple of weeks ago. Anyway.
Stuart, is there anything else you want to ask Stuart, or we'll go to someone else?
There is a couple of things. If I'm not
just keep going, because we want to come back to this peppering business. Hamish, you might sort of introduce that as time goes on with what George White's got to say. But if that's too hard for you,
yep.
I'll bring it in. So, Stuart, just keep going.
A couple of other things. I think I recall in the DVDs that someone made mention that cattle will drink the 500 solution.
Yes.
Is that something viable if I have the cattle in the yards to put some 500 solution in a trough and just see if they would do that?
I think you want to be careful on that, because you've got to look at what the regulations are in relation to you want to make sure that in the 500 there is no animal material, because you're not allowed to give animal material back to animals. And
yeah,
no,
I think
that.
The quantities we're talking about are not, and it's not actually animal material at that point. What I used to do is, if I brought new cattle onto the property, that's what I'd do. I'd do it anyway for a quietening thing, but I'd leave them in the yards with some hay and just put some of the biodynamic soil activator in the trough and let them get it into their gut and take it out with them. So yes, that's a good way of doing it. Especially if you have large areas where getting over the countryside is difficult.
Thank you for bringing that to my attention, because the BD product actually changes by the fact that it's cured, or the bacteria and the fungi have worked on it.
It's not animal product at that stage. In the same sense.
Thank you for clearing that up.
Okay. I just have one more question. I think someone also made mention that they've actually, sprayed it on the cattle, or just poured a little bit on the cattle as well.
Sorry about that. That's me. Look, I don't think it applies in your situation. This was a guy in Namibia on country that you could hardly ride a horse over. So that was the way he got it out over his land. Yeah,
right.
Because he couldn't do it any other way. In your situation, I don't think that's applicable. Certainly, put them in the trough. But in the conditions you're in, I'd get your fire pump and stir it and get it out.
Okay. Thanks very much. That's all the questions for me.
Thanks, Stuart. Now, look, that's a great question, Stuart, because farmers are finding it a little bit hard to get their minds around biodynamics, yet, as you heard John say, it's a fairly straightforward process once you can start on it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hamish, do you want to sort of start on those questions that... George White had in relation to how he makes his weed preparations and the timing, because things.
Okay, well, the making of the pepper, we've covered that. It's basically getting certainly the viable seed. If you can get the whole plant and ash that to a black ash, and then, as John described, you can mix that in with your preparation, your soil activator as it's going out, and that'll help weaken the germination of the plants. And that increases over years. In other words, if you keep doing it each year, the weakening will have more effect. I also need to say that it seems to be different. If you have been using the biodynamic preparations, then the peppers will tend to work better. So it's a bit of a total picture. In other words, if you can get the soil active, get that what I call intelligence happening in the soil, then things like peppers have a better chance of working.
I think there's also the point, Hamish, that in a lot of cases, plants that you consider to be weeds, once you rebalance the soil, they don't occur anyway because you've made them redundant as well.
That's right. And that's why the weed teas and the biodynamic preparations are really the way to go. The peppering is a place of last resort. And often, if you haven't actually fixed the problem, as John describes, and you use a pepper, you might be very successful. That plant won't grow, but then another one will come in its place to do the job. So there's no shortcut in this thing. It's really important to get the soil where the soil needs to be, and then the plants that are coming in as messengers will cease to worry you. So the weed tea, again, you get the weed, the whole weed, root and all, stick it in water in a 44-gallon drum, 200-litre drum. You can half to fill it with weeds and then fill it with water, and then stick a set of biodynamic compost preparations in it. And once you've made it up, it'll take a month or two to rot down, but then it'll keep a long time. But in biodynamics, we don't make the preparations to keep them. They're made to sort of put out. So never worry greatly about how long they're going to last. If you think you've been having it a bit long, stick another set of compost preparation, or give it a stir, stick another set of compost preparations in and go for it. But basically, once made, they'll last a year or two, and you know, you'd expect to use them within the year anyway.
Because the question was whether they'd last 4 or 6 months. So you're saying a year or two, that covers well and truly 4 or 6 months.
Yeah. Look, everything in biodynamics, you'll find it fits a cycle. In other words, if you harvest, so to speak, you collect the weed when it's in full growth and flower, etc., and then make your tea, you then really want to be putting it out before that plant would germinate the next time. So these things fit into your annual cycle. So you harvest it, so to speak, at harvest time, and you put the weed tea out with the preparations, in the autumn.
Yeah, when the weed that you're aiming at is when it's dormant, before it has it regenerates.
And as I said, the thing to do is to actually think it through into your annual cycle, so these things just become part of your annual cycle, like shearing or harvesting or whatever it is.
And what about couch grass, Hamish? Does that require any special treatment or?
John, couch grass, your...
Yeah, well, couch, there's two things about couch. It is, it probably helps to propagate better than any other plant all of the fungi that we need in the soil. Having said that, you'll find with couch, once you get the 500 or soil activator onto the land where it is, it becomes more attractive to cattle, and simply the cattle grazing it more heavily and intensely, you will find that you don't have to work it out or spend any money getting rid of it. The cattle will flog it down and it loses its pioneering capability as the quality of it improves.
John, that's a very good question for grazing people. So keep talking about that, but then I want you to look at the fact that George doesn't have animals on his place. He's just cropping only.
Right. Well, in most cases, if he gets his pH up to about 6.5 and introduces legumes, it will it will lose its pioneering capability. In a tree situation with trees, it's just not a problem. But in most open farming situations, to me, it is one of those plants that are a great indicator of the depletion of organic matter in the soil. And because it is in its natural state or without the preparations on it, it isn't attractive to animals, and that's what it's designed for. So what grows up can go back into the soil to increase the organic matter in the soil. So really, it is a messenger that we need to get organic matter in the soil. One chap, he's down on the south coast somewhere. He was working making compost as a saleable product, as an additional income to his property. And where they spread it on an area that was very heavy with couch, the couch immediately lost its pioneering capability, and they got a wonderful cover of all sorts of plants that they didn't have before. So I think it is responsive to overcoming the problem that it's trying to do.
Good. Hamish, the other... Well, getting on to the compost question, which George has, he says, when I make compost, which I have added minerals to it, like rock dust, calcium, etc., will these minerals be applied through the tea? In other words, can he sort of liquefy the compost and spread it out? So is that a possibility? Would he lose the effect of the minerals by liquefying the compost?
No.
John, do you want to go with that?
No, look, once the minerals have been through the bacteria and fungi, one, they're stabilised and they become fully plant available. So it changes its character altogether. It is not like a handful of agricultural lime, or it's far better to use burnt lime anyway. But it is stabilised by the bacteria and the fungi, and look, you probably get 10 or 15 times better effect or more availability than he would if he put it straight onto the ground. So my answer is yes, whatever he turns into good compost will make good compost tea.
And just to pick up on people like Elaine Ingham or in the biodynamic work Maria Tun, there's a general acceptance that a liquid compost is good for 5 to 6 months, where a solid compost is more likely to be good for 5 to 6 years. So, if you take 5 years, if you can develop a regime where you're making enough compost and every 5 years a paddock gets it, then that's ideal. But in the short term, you may well find that putting a liquid compost out gives you, you can get over more of the property quicker, but it won't have as much lasting effect.
I think as far as Elaine Ingham and some of the other researchers are concerned, they are looking at the immediate available increase in production. They are not looking at the introduction and the build-up of the mycorrhizae and everything else in the soil that is going to remain there unless they're killed out, you know, by submersion from floods or fungicides or something like that. So I think, you know, I agree with what they're saying. The measurable effect above the ground might only last for 6 months, but they are repopulating and really getting the soil going. So I think I'm a great believer in doing as much as you can when we're talking bacteria and fungi that multiply, that if we can get it happening over all of our place, it's far better than concentrating on small bits of it at a time.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's why really, if you can get the biodynamic soil activator out at least once a year and preferably twice,
yep,
then that's what's going to be the most effective way of achieving what John's talking about.
Now, Hamish, I think we've covered all of George's questions, have we?
I think so, yeah, unless someone thinks otherwise.
No, well, yes, it's...
Probably with the cooch, you know, he's not running cattle?
No, he's got no stock at all. He's got thousands of acres and cereals and maybe a legume or so in rotation.
Right.
And it's no sheep at all.
Probably with if he could do his mulching or slashing or whatever method he is using to get the cooch or to keep it down, if he was to time his work on the cooch to new moon, he would probably find that will definitely hold its regrowth back dramatically.
Okay. Worth a try.
With cooch. Yeah, just do the, you know, if he slashes it or mulches it or even if you work it, if you can do it on new moon, it is much more effective at steadying its regeneration down.
Look, I'll say something not because I think it's practical, but it's something to think about. These people that don't have just crops and no animals, if you can somehow create a rotation where some cattle are on the countryside in your rotation somewhere, it is highly beneficial. Just in a vineyard, which is not cropping, but the story still holds good. James Milton, you know, was doing his biodynamics, and Peter Proctor always used to say to him, look, you need compost and you need animals in your vineyard. And after about 10 years, James got around to making compost and putting that out. And he rang up Peter and said, why didn't you tell me to use compost? You know, it's just so effective. And then another 10 years later, he got himself some of those midget Herefords, I think, and put a few of those.
No, they were Devons, yeah.
Devons, were they? He put them in his vineyard and rang up Peter and said, why in the hell didn't you tell me to put cattle in my vineyard before? Because they've been so effective. And, you know, vineyards, people don't think about, you know, animals in vineyards, but they can be very effective in stimulating the fertility in the soil and the life in the soil. And it's the same in sugar plantations. You know, the people who can actually get a cycle or a rotation of cattle, it has a huge effect. So I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but if you can find a way to get that animal, particularly cattle, influence onto your cropping country, I'm totally confident you'll see a benefit.
I think a way to do that is look at adjusting cattle for a few months of the year on, you know, do that in rotation. So you're getting an income from what the cattle are grazing without having to go to the expense of buying cattle.
Well, I'd just like to add that, because a lot of people will say it's impractical for a lot of people, but it really is worth doing, you'll find. So if you can find a way to trial that and work with it, on top of the biodynamic preparations, I'm sure you'll see a benefit.
That's a good question. Now, getting on to the composting side of things, we saw what you did, Hamish, on that DVD. Now, John, what sort of products do you put into your compost, or what sort of products would you advocate people to put into compost, like on a larger scale? We saw the sort of a small scale where you can do things fairly ideally, but on a larger scale, what are some of the products that you'd put in or suggest people put in?
In my case, with the when I had the 6,000 citrus trees, all of the prunings went through a chipper and became the bottom 8 or 10 inches, sometimes a couple of foot, of the base of the heaps. And then in most cases, it was animal manure out of our yards, spoiled hay, loosened hay, or whatever sort of, in most cases it would be spoiled loosened hay, layered in with the manure, clay from what we cleaned out of our earth dams, anything at all, the fish from the carp eradication scheme, the 200 metre heaps in most years, they would be getting, you know, $150, $200 of carp straight into the heap. Like anything, like kangaroos or anything like that happened to run into an unmarked gum tree are terrific. Whatever you can get that you know, has been alive, the best way to regain everything that's gone into them is putting them through compost. But I, in most cases, my compost heap on making would probably be 9 foot tall and about 14 feet wide at the bottom and 200 metres long. Basalt dust I also included, but you know, anything that well, I always say that, you know, if we eliminate the word waste from our vocabulary and change that word to potential, everything that has an organic base is potential fertility when we put it through our compost heap. So basically pasture or the chips, pasture toppings, spoiled hay, manure from the cattle yards, and the, you know, topped up with the kangaroos and the carp and everything else that I can get to put in there.
Good.
And can I just say, with compost, it one of the things that out of experience, start with a fairly modest compost heap and just learn to get the balance of protein, carbohydrate and moisture right before you start going into big ones. Because as John said, you can use whatever you've got at hand, but make some, you know, modest ones first to get a feel for what's working and what isn't working. Because if it basically there are two things that can go wrong. It can be too wet or too dry. And you know, if you to get all of that balance right, if it's a smaller heap, you don't have so much to do to correct it if it's out of balance. Once you've got a feel for it, then make heaps the size of John's by all means.
I think probably, Hamish, the greatest thing that I've learned about making compost in larger quantities is putting it on a slight slope, level, but on a slight slope, so the watering. I just put a little bank at each end, and fill that little reservoir about a foot deep right along the compost heap. And I reckon I wouldn't even use 10% of the water that I did over the years trying to irrigate and keeping it wet from the outside. When you put it through, let it run through on the base, it transpires upwards, and you can regulate the moisture content of the heap more accurately with very, very little water.
That's great, great revision there, John. Now, Hamish and John, I want to say ask two things about the composting, and both you can just chip in and answer these. When it comes to the preparations that farmers put into the compost heap, what are the preparations? How would they make them? And is it better for them initially so that it doesn't become daunting to just buy them from you?
Initially, certainly, I'd be buying them. And they're the Biodynamic compost preparations. You can also, like, I think John makes a fish emulsion using the preparations and puts that in.
And then also I use that to put into the compost heap.
Yeah. So you can, if it's huge, if you're trying to make huge compost heaps, you can make what I call a sort of a starter compost that's a really good one, and then, you know, put that into a larger one, so to speak, so you're bringing that influence in. But normally you can buy the compost preparations and you just put them in little balls of old compost and stick them into the heap. It's not very complicated to do. And start with being a bit modest with it, get to know it, and then you can make big ones.
I think probably the other thing to add about the compost preparations, you can do it in a static heap. I only turn mine once during the whole process. If I was using that mechanical method of turning and working the compost continually, the cost would be so much more in labour, in fuel, than it is simply by inserting the compost preparations and leaving it as a static heap, that I think it is just so far in front that it is foolish to consider making compost without using the compost preparations.
John, do you monitor the temperature on the compost, and how do you monitor the temperature, especially if it's
well,
not
I've
so
got
high?
Silage, the big silage thermometers, which, it's about 18 inches long and fairly heavy, but you still, you know, need to be careful with them. And I insert that, and I believe that, well, I've not had any weeds germinate once I get up around that 59 degrees Celsius. I think once what I have had, Dr. Jeff Rigby's work, was that one lot got to... it got up around 71 or 72 degrees, and there was a marked decrease in both bacteria and fungi numbers. So I think that 59, 60 degrees, try not to go over that. And if you can get up that 59, 60 degrees, I don't know of any seed that is going to remain viable.
Good, good. All right. If there's anyone online, press star 7 and ask us a question. And that also means, Stuart, you're most welcome to come back. Don't feel you have to stay quiet. Hamish, you'd like to say anything at all?
Just back to the compost. The last time I heard Elaine Ingham speak about compost, her method is turning it pretty regularly, every few days. And she gave a spirited description of composting in her world. She then took a deep breath and said, well, there's another way to make compost, and that's the biodynamic way, which she said, I call that a vermicompost. And she said the biodynamic people only turn it once. And that's just confirming what John said. We actually let the worms and the microbes do all the work. You don't have to spend horsepower and fuel and hours constantly turning it. And a lot of the stuff that I've seen constantly turned ends up what I call mulch. It's broken down. It looks all brown and it is organic. But to me, a real compost is something that has been through a microbe, been through a worm, and you get this rich colloidal substance. And by doing the static heap and just turning it once so that the outside becomes the inside and vice versa, so that all the seeds and everything get cooked and processed, that seems to be sufficient. And again, as I said earlier, if you fit these things into your annual cycle, you'll find you don't need to be making compost that's ready in 2 weeks or 6 weeks. You can actually make your compost long enough ahead so that it's ready when you need it. And as I said, like shearing, like putting out the bulls or calf marking or whatever, it's you fit it into the annual cycle, and then it'll just you let it cook and let the microbes do the work. It's cheaper and easier and more enjoyable.
I think, Hamish, my description of the mechanically speeded compost, it is not as high a percentage humus as the static heap is using the compost preparations.
I agree.
And
yeah.
It is, it's the humus that we want.
Yeah.
And I think the percentages in humus, the only lot that I've had tested in about the last 10 years, there is a big difference. And I think that's what we get by making conditions suitable for the microbes to do the work for us.
Yeah, that's a very good differentiation between humus and organic matter. Organic matter is not necessarily humus.
No.
I think one very good point that I'd like to bring up is if there's someone wanting to check the difference between compost turning and the biodynamic system, why wouldn't they try both systems and evaluate for themselves without bellyaching too much about it?
Absolutely, yeah.
By all means, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Just on that, there's a retired vet who's doing some work at the... at his local school down at Scott's Head down here, and he got the school kids to do all the work, and he did the scientific monitoring sort of thing. And after about a year, he gave up doing any of the organic stuff. He said the biodynamic stuff was just so far ahead that he just gave up on the organic. So, by all means, trial it, and then you work out of your own experience.
Yeah. Why take anyone else's word for it? Give it a try. And as you say, as you illustrated, when Peter Proctor worked with that vineyard person, it took 8 or 10 years for step one, or 8 or 10 years to step two. So if you can learn on the wisdom of you two gentlemen, you can save sort of 16 or 20 years.
Yeah, 50.
Look, I mean, it's all fine. Look, concept's not easy to change your mind when you've been influenced by industrial influences for so long. So, mind you, biodynamics has been going for 90 or 100 years, so I think there's plenty of proof that it does work.
Look, my experience is that the mindset in the bush is certainly softening up, if not opening up. And I see people now, open to biological or different ways that 5 years ago wouldn't have even given you the time of day on it. So it is changing.
Great, great. And how do you find that, John?
Well, I think that to me it's extremely encouraging because I believe that all farmers have powers of observation that very quickly identify any worthwhile results that they get. They can see improvements, they can see, and I think this is largely what led them into fully artificial methods, was that very quickly there is a result that they can actually see. And I think now that the that artificial fertilizers and all of the other things and the depletion of our organic matter in our soils has got to the point where it is now to, you know, for instance, people who have been using superphosphate, single superphosphate, who may have started with 200 weight to the acre, ended up with double that amount and not getting any results. Immediately they reintroduced the biology to the soil to release that tied up phosphorus. They got better results than they got from even their first application of superphosphate. And this really excites them, and so I think it is only a matter of getting them started once we get that life actively operating in the soil and making what is tied up on the clay colloids, make it available to the plants. It is very, very recognisable. The other thing is that flavour, colour and keeping quality are very, very quickly, like in any single crop, the first lot of mature fruit or vegetables that you get, the flavour, the keeping quality and the colour and the aroma are just so much enhanced that most people get up and gallop with it.
Great, great. John, I've got a question that was asked yesterday by one of our farmers in South Australia. Laurie was his first name. And he's on Kingston, South Australia. That's where his property is. And it's been sort of marshy floodplains off the Murray, and it's been drained, and he's still got salt pans on parts of his property, which he's correcting. You did mention some work that you did on with salt pans or salt areas. What's something he could do?
Well, I think the main thing is to get the fresh water back onto the top of the salt water, which in one place where Hamish and I have done workshops over the years, the first application of the BD preparations, actually, we visited the property. It's quite a big property. And there was, well, you could stand in any one spot and see salt schools, some of them about as big as a bathtub, some a bit bigger. But they were all over the property. After the first two applications, they started to disappear. 2 years later, it was very, very difficult to find any of those scald patches at all. And when you actually went out and dug, you could see that the water was now sort of the fresh water, was about 6 or 7 inches deep into the soil, which was pushing the salt water back.
Are we talking about rainwater? Because that's the only water he's got.
Rainwater?
Yeah, that's his only water he can put on top would be rainwater, meaning
yeah, that's
the rain.
It. Yeah, but I mean, putting it on top, you need it down in the soil to push the saline back into the soil.
Yep.
All of our, like that is the source of salinity in Australia, is the lack of fresh water holding the salt water down. And
right.
Exactly the situation, you know, draining our wet lands because that was our best soil. When we drained it, we simply let the salt water come to the surface.
Right. And so you would use a BD preparation to start the process?
Absolutely, yeah, to improve the soil structure, to let the fresh water go down 6 inches instead of running off.
Right.
You know, we've got to have that inflow of the rainwater to actually soak into the soil where it falls to push the salt back down again.
Which BD preparations would you use? Both of them?
Yeah, well, the soil activator and then the 500 or any of them, but certainly the soil activator to start with, and then the 500.
The 501, the silica, yep.
Yeah, and the silica. Well, the silica is in the preparation, but, yeah, we need silica is very important in the in improving the soil structure, because it's bringing light into the soil, and where you've got light, you've got life. So yeah, we need it all, but you know, probably three or four applications a year, and you will find that the salt water will be pushed down by the retention of the fresh water in the topsoil.
Good, very good. If anyone else wants to ask a question, just press star 7 and start talking. Don't wait for us to stop. Now, we're getting closer to finishing. Hamish and John, is there anything that you'd like to have to say to farmers as a message that encourages them?
Probably a lot of the areas that have had so much flooding this year, I think one of the quickest way to reduce the amount of activity in our soil, both fungal and bacteria, is flooding or water logging. And you know, fortunately, we can, with the 50% or the agricultural hydrogen peroxide, we can add oxygen back into the soil, which really stimulates the bacteria and fungi. And if we add energy to that in the form of molasses, we can really rejuvenate our soil quickly after it's been inundated with flood, or if it's been drought affected for a long time, or if it's been compacted by stimulating our bacteria with energy and oxygen via hydrogen peroxide and molasses. We can really rejuvenate our soil quickly when it's had a hard time.
Well, a lot of what you just said, flood, dryness, compaction. Compaction is one very big problem. So that covers, you've covered a lot there, John.
Yeah, that 50% hydrogen peroxide, are only using one part of it in 130 parts of water. So it works out like in a lot of the very, very heavy black soil country that compacts, it's only costing, the actual material is only costing about 80 cents a hectare, the hydrogen peroxide. So it's cheaper than using any other sort of aeration machinery or anything else.
What was the proportion of molasses?
In molasses, about 1 in 40.
Yep.
One part of molasses, 40 parts of water. But yep, the hydrogen peroxide, if it's 50% hydrogen peroxide, it's 1 in 130. One part hydrogen peroxide in 130 parts of water.
Right, right. Now, Hamish, what would you like to say for farmers in relation to biodynamics and the last two DVDs that they would have seen?
Well, you know, I do what I do because I when I first came across biodynamics, we'd been through the 60s drought, and if we can actually build humus into the soil, we can actually make Australia both drought tolerant and flood tolerant. In other words, in this 10-year drought, the biodynamic guys, or the people who had their soil, had good soil, good humic soil, were the last into the drought. And they were the first out of the drought. When it did rain, like Shane Joyce in Queensland was saying, that he had a moisture profile coming out of the drought where the moisture went down 2 feet and then it was powder dry. And he said the grass was pouring out of the ground for him, where his neighbour, who just had compacted soil, virtually had no growth. So he came out of the drought pretty quickly. With flood, the more humus and the more air and the more life you've got in the soil, the more slowly the water will go through the soil. So you will lose some of the wash, and you'll hold a lot of that moisture in the water in the soil, and the organic matter will tend to hang together more, so you'll have less erosion.
Less leaching of the nutrients in the soil.
Yes, because
with the organic matter
held in the humus.
Yeah,
and so that's what first attracted me to this, and then I find that it's actually also the cheapest and the easiest. And I don't want to go into the different other sort of organic and biological systems, but I can assure you if you research any of these, even if you're buying the biodynamic preparations, it's pretty well the cheapest. And once you've got yourself up and running, you can make all these preparations yourself. And once you've achieved that, then you've really got very, very little input cost. And so that's one end of it. And on the quality end, I believe that food quality is going to become very important, because the deficiency illnesses, the degenerative illnesses are increasing. And we have to be able to grow the food that will nourish people. And one thing that gave me great hope, there's an expat Australian farming in upstate New York. He's been there for 20, 30 years. I visited him 20 years ago. But he said there's a new movement in New Jersey. They're called the New Jersey Mums. And these are young professional women who are highly technical, savvy, intelligent, you know, doing well in what they're doing. And they're starting to have children. And so they're starting to face all the parenthood issues, vaccinations, raw milk, you know, organic food, whatever. And they're using their technical savvy, social media savvy, and their professional attitude, and they're really starting to look for decent food, because they're doing their research and they're finding that actually whatever the politicians say, whatever the big scientists say, on the social media level, people are reporting good results from good food. And we've got to be ready for these guys, because they can, there's large numbers of them, and they can change their eating habits overnight. We can't change the farming production overnight. I believe we can change it in very few years, but we've got to be ready for these guys, because they're going to be the market of the future, driving where we're going in a certain sense. And so I'm totally confident the biodynamics will give you good results. It'll be quality food, quality produce. It'll be relatively cheap to do. Just on that level, just right down to your ploughing. Arthur Dakin, growing wheat out at Ningen, he was downsizing his tractor to pull the same plough, while his neighbour was upsizing his tractor to pull the same plough. The neighbour's soil was getting harder and harder, and Arthur's soil was getting more and more friable. He used less horsepower to cultivate. So, on all aspects, whether it's flood or drought, your cost regime, your weed regime, your worm burdens in animals, etc., that's all one side of it. But don't lose track. There is a generation coming through, or there is a serious proportion of a generation coming through that are going to come knocking on your door in the next 10 years. And if you're ready, the market's there.
Now, on that note, I'd like to ask you, John, or to you explain, John, because I heard from your wife that a lot of your citrus goes to people who are doing home deliveries, which ties in with what Hamish was saying. Would you like to comment on that, please, John?
Well, probably in the last 4 years, one lady who does it, she bought the business that was supplying 50 boxes. She just refers to them as boxes, of fruit and vegetables a week. The following year, it was 75, and the next year it was 150. This year is 225. So that was a start from 50 customers that she bought when she bought the business. She's now 225. So there's a remarkable growth. As far as meat is concerned, I don't think, you know, it's going to be years before we catch the supply catches up with demand. And I think that there is a ready sale for top quality stuff. At this stage, we can be price makers if our product is good enough. And I know of no other way of increasing the quality of our food to the same extent as we can by using the biodynamic preparations and our management. Like the preparations are one part, but our management must also cater for diversity and really work on the things that do happen naturally. And I think that the market is there for the taking at this stage.
Wonderful. I think we'll wrap up now. Hamish, would you like to, what's your final say on what we've had to say today or the last two DVDs, whichever way you want to say it?
Look, if people watch the DVDs, John and I, we do workshops pretty well around the countryside. If you'd like a workshop in your area, just contact me and we can work that out. And by all means, contact me if there are any questions, anything you'd like to follow up. I'm very, very happy to hear from you. And I can supply all the preparations and everything you need to get started.
And they contact you which way? What's the best way to contact you?
Either office at biodynamics2024.com.au or 02-6657-5270. There's a website.
Get it from your website.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Hamish. Now, John, would you like to sort of sum up, or what's the final thing you might like to say?
Oh, well, I think, my final wish is that everyone who is interested in increasing the fertility of their farm and increasing the quality of their crops, whatever it is, I don't think there is a better way of doing it. I get a lot of pleasure out of giving back to something that's been wonderful to me. And I don't mind as long as, like, if people sort of respect that I'm available after 7:30 at night. And I think you've got my phone number, haven't you, Hugo? Would be going out with your material?
No, we don't. I don't think it is.
Oh, right. It's 02-49-385-116.
Wonderful. I appreciate that. I'd like to thank both of you gentlemen for your generosity in all accounts. The fact that you did this talk at Crinklewood, the fact you allow us to film it, and you've made a big influence on a lot of farmers now. Quite a few farmers have commented and they like the idea of changing towards this natural way. So I really do see that you gentlemen are part of the change to a better way of farming for farmers, and farmers are appreciating it now. So on that note, and also as you would have heard Stuart saying, there's farmers like Stuart who are keen and wanting to change.
Well, I'd say to Stuart, get in touch. John and I can come and do a workshop out there, that to me is the best way. I think what Hugo and Helen are doing is fantastic, but it really makes a big difference to be on the spot and, talking eyeball to eyeball and just seeing what the situation is.
Well, Hamish, that's exactly what John wants to do. He does want to be running sort of having his farm to be a training facility.
Great.
Well, we're very happy to. Anyway, if he gets in touch, we can do that.
Totally good. On that note, I'd like to thank both Hamish Mackay and John Priestley for coming online, and also, I'd like to thank the farmers, because it is the farmers who make the difference in our world. So I'd like to thank all you farmers who have been online, and hopefully you can see the value of taking up
something that is cheap and economical.
Fantastic. And thank you, Hugo and Helen.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.